station since 1981.
And that's a long time. Well, Paul Muthin with News from Neptune, the radio edit. I'm flagging today. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's the pollen. Opinions you hear here are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. And we hope you support free speech radio, diversity of culture and information. Any way you can. You can always go to weft.org and check out the options. I suppose you could probably still get a tote bag and a baseball cap, since those were the premiums for the drive. I guess I should get one. I have one, but it doesn't fit. My head's getting thicker. Okay, that's a good opening line. I got a replay. I think that Vijay Prashad is important enough to hear again. It was just on yesterday on Democracy Now. Maybe you missed it. Maybe you want to hear it again. Maybe you want to tell somebody about it and get into more details of it. Different perspective. I played an earlier interview with him. I don't think I should do a lot of freelancing. I thought I was going to prepare some stuff about COVID. The commentary from Amy Goodman is about COVID and national health care. There's an NPR program called Through Lines that I thought did a pretty good job of covering the post-war, World War II, that is, move towards a national health care. Happened in the UK at that time. That's when they kicked Khrushchev. They kicked Churchill out. Everybody's lionizing Churchill so much. He was such a cad, and the UK knew. They voted him out after the war and voted it in Clement Attlee, who was pretty nondescript, but he got a National Health Service in. What else? Economic issues. It's tax day late. I'm always late. I'm neurotic about money, but let's not go there either. I thought I should do something economics. Dean Baker's a click into, he's done a lot of great work. Got some analysis for him. It's kind of odd. He says that Ukrainian and Russian wheat is only 4% of the world's production, but then most people consume their own food. Internally, it's 40% of exports, so it is having a massive effect. But I didn't really realize that that was something. Doesn't change the hunger around the world, but makes it clearer that the prices are probably more related to speculation. I would commend your attention to something I played a few weeks ago. Didn't play the whole thing. Need to go back and listen to it again myself. From Deconstructed with Ryan Grimm. He'd interviewed an author whose name I don't have in front of me, but a book about are prices the engine of chaos? He says the amount of speculative money that's in commodities is distorting the economic system for what it's worth in the first place. There's a line in it about how does the death of Anne Hathaway, should it really have anything to do with the algorithmic training of Berkshire Hathaway? And it's obvious that it shouldn't, but algorithms don't know that. That's a butterfly wing, I guess. Chaos theory. All right. I'd said I wasn't going to ramble, and here I have. Dean Baker was seminal in some early days of the epidemic when he was talking about the TRIPS agreement and why we needed to start producing vaccinations around the world. It still hasn't been heeded. It still hasn't been done. It's grim, and I think BA4 should actually be called a new Greek letter, but I guess we're tired of that too. BA4, you might not have heard about yet, but it's waiting in the wings for its walk-on. It seems to have a possibility that it's immunity evasive, which is scary because we're deciding about getting boosters and et cetera. Brian Edward Tickert does a regular Monday morning interview with a virologist that I make regular listening. I've been recommending it for a while. And one thing I learned last week is that the J&J vaccine is not as bad as everyone was saying. It actually does have some good effects, and it was never should have never been sold and marketed as a one shot. It's a two shot at least. I'm considering getting it instead of an mRNA booster. I've gotten a Moderna, Pfizer, and now a J&J. My quip about Johnson & Johnson's vaccine is, would you take a vaccine from a company that can't even make talc safely? But maybe they have a different division. Okay, some more on... No Mumia Abu-Jamal again. I'm kind of worried. I hope he's doing well, and as I always say, hope he's working on his legal case and maybe another book. Amy Goodman's got the commentary Breaking the Sound Barrier. Let's kick it with that. And then also a Brian Edwards Tickert interview with a guy from, I guess it's Public Citizen or Politico, working with Public Citizen on revelations from the tax, from IRA. Somebody leaked some... IRS. Let's break the sound barrier here and see if I can get my English, broken English back together here again.
Confront COVID's racial and class disparities with Medicare for All. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. We're done with COVID, but COVID is not done with us. The subvariant of Omicron, dubbed BA.2, is causing spikes in infections, hospitalizations, deaths, and lockdowns in different parts of the world. In the United States, the statistics have been promising, but cases have been rising enough to prompt the CDC on Wednesday to extend the national mask mandate for travel hubs and public transit, including planes, for an additional 2 weeks until May 3rd, and also extended the national public health emergency determination for an additional 90 days. While BA.2 creates uncertainty in the course of the pandemic, one fact has become increasingly clear. COVID-19 has exposed significant disparities in how healthcare is delivered and accessed in our society. In the initial months of the pandemic in early 2020, Black Americans were 3 times more likely than whites to contract COVID-19 and to require hospitalization, and twice as likely to die of the disease. The Poor People's Campaign summarized in its recent Poor People's Pandemic Report, quote, "The pandemic exacerbated pre-existing social and economic disparities that have long festered in the U.S., including a deeply divided society, widespread poverty, a weak social safety net, inadequate living conditions, and a lack of trust in science that predated COVID-19," unquote. These dysfunctions and inequity won't be overcome until everyone, regardless of who they are or where they're from, are guaranteed health care as a fundamental right. One of the most compelling speakers on the subject of universal health care is no longer able to physically speak at all. Activist Addie Barkin was diagnosed with terminal ALS in 2016. He uses a system that translates his eye movements into spoken words.
"It's shameful that in the richest country in the world, we choose to inflict so much suffering,"
Addie Barkin said, testifying remotely before a recent House committee hearing on Medicare for All.
"The pandemic has revealed and exacerbated the existing inequalities in our profit-driven healthcare system. It has hit hardest on disabled people, poor people, Black, Latino, and Indigenous people, and especially people who live at the intersections of these categories. And 1 out of 3 COVID-19 deaths in the U.S. are related to gaps in health insurance. nearly a million Americans have already died from the coronavirus. How much more is necessary to shock our legislators into action?
Medicare for All is a proposed reform of the U.S. healthcare system that would take the popular Medicare health insurance program, currently available to citizens and permanent residents 65 years of age and older, and extend eligibility to all. Medicare is a form of single-payer healthcare in which the government itself does not provide medical services, but makes the payments on behalf of those who it covers. Thus, hospitals, doctor's offices, pharmacies, and the like all remain as they are. The for-profit health insurance companies, however, are removed from the equation, saving over $500 billion per year. That's half a trillion dollars per year, as estimated in a report by Public Citizen. Medicare for All also guarantees that no one would be left uninsured. The Kaiser Family Foundation estimates the current number of uninsured people in the U.S. at around 30 million.
When this pandemic started, there was an awareness that our healthcare system was not going to perform well with 30 million uninsured, with far more underinsured.
That's Dr. Adam Gaffney of Harvard Medical School speaking on Democracy Now! He co-authored a study that showed uninsured people are more likely to contract COVID-19.
We need to be expanding our public health infrastructure to tackle not only the pandemic of the present, but the pandemics of the future, to say nothing of the other health threats that face us in the years to come, like the impact of climate change and much more.
The pandemic has hit Black Americans particularly hard. In a new report, The State of Black America and COVID-19 by the Black Coalition Against COVID, the Yale School of Medicine, the Morehouse School of Medicine, and others, Yale's Dr. Marcella Nunez-Smith writes, in January of 2022, rates of COVID-19 hospitalization for Black Americans were the highest they've been since the pandemic start. Dr. Oni Blackstock, an African-American primary care and HIV physician, founder of Health Justice, said on the Democracy Now! NewsHour,
the reality is that we are all interconnected and that, if the Black community has, access to care, to safety measures, that actually is something that can protect all of us.
I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan. Democracy Now! democracynow.org.
Okay, there's a little snafu. Okay, that won't... Oh my gosh. We're going to go to Dean Baker with Ryan Edwards-Tiekert, and that should be right here. Yeah. This is a short interview. They had some technical difficulties. The next segment he did also the same day, and it's not available on the archive. I don't know. It seemed like a great interview to me. I think it was inadvertent, and maybe it was because their techie had to work on it in the archives and fix it as well as they could, and somehow one of the interviews got deleted. It's short. It's about this data dump, a leak from the IRS. I thought that was apropos this time of the year. So the war will be discussed by Vijay Prashad in the interview that I'll be playing in the second half hour, if I can get this all together here. There, that's better. I feel better already. Thanks for tuning in, and... Here's Brian Edwards-Tiekert talking about food prices.
We're just getting into the details on food. I should mention this week the United Nations also issued a report saying food prices are spawning an absolute crisis around the world in places where food expenditures, can make up the majority of most household budgets.
Yeah, we have seen a big jump in food prices, and that's been worldwide. Part of it is due to Ukraine, although I think that's exaggerated. Ukraine produced about 4% of world wheat production. Clearly, that will be hit by the war. It's not going to go to zero, but it's not that unusual to see a 4% rise or fall in world wheat production just because of random weather events. But it's a fact. World food prices, particularly wheat, other grains, those have gone up a huge amount since the pandemic began. So again, it's not necessarily just Ukraine, but the higher wheat prices, higher food prices is a reality, and that's particularly a problem in developing countries. And it's a problem here. Food's obviously a large portion of the budget for low moderate income people. So the question is, are they going to see better news on that in the future? I think we probably will see some. I think part of this, the supply chain story, part of that goes to food in the sense that it's become much more expensive to bring things like milk, meat, other items to market. So I think we will see improvements on that in the months ahead. But no doubt about it, that's been a big hit to a lot of people. Food prices are up almost 9% over the last year.
Are the inflation figures showing any effect yet from the Federal Reserve starting to tighten interest rates?
I think it's too early on that. We are seeing definitely a hit to the housing market, which isn't a surprise. So interest rates have been going up, and where you see this very clearly, mortgage interest rates by some measures are over 5%. They had been around 3% if you go back to the summer of 2020. So people, well, for one, they're not refinancing mortgages. Refinancing mortgages has just gone through the floor because there are very few people that could profitably refinance a mortgage at, let's say, a 5% interest rate. Even if you had one that was slightly higher, you're not going to save anything much on that. So mortgage refinancing has gone through the floor, which means both that itself was a major source of business activity. But on top of that, someone refinanced a mortgage and saved 1 percentage point on interest, which was probably fairly common. If you had a $250,000 mortgage, that's $2,500 a year in your pocket. That stopped. We are also seeing some reduction in home buying. So again, it has had a hit there. But in other areas of the economy, I think you'd be hard-pressed to see too much evidence of that impact, which, again, shouldn't be surprising because they haven't raised rates that much. So most of the story here is simply the expectation. So the rate that they directly control, the overnight money rate, that's only gone up a quarter point. So that's not a big deal. But what we have seen is the longer-term interest rates, which do have more impact on the economy, those have risen, and that's due to the expectation that they will be raising rates more.
You mentioned the fact that oil prices are dropping. I'm curious of what you make of the positioning by some Democrats that partly what's happening at the pump is a result of price gouging, not supply and demand fundamentals.
Oil prices, gas prices have followed oil prices up. It's not surprising that they take longer to go down. There's a logic to this in the sense that suppose you're a gas station. A lot of gas stations are franchises. They're owner-operated. I mean, they're affiliated with Exxon or whoever, but they're owner-operated. They pay for their oil when it's put in the ground, you know, when they put it in their tanks. And you can't expect that the world price of oil's dropped, so the next load of gas is going to cost them less. They're going to be very reluctant to lower the price on the gas when they've already paid for it and sitting in their tanks. So I don't see anything obviously out of line there. I mean, it's a pattern you can go back through decades. You'd see the same sort of story. So I do think the gas prices will fall. But again, a lot depends on the price of oil. That is the underlying factor there. But I do think they will fall more. They've come down some, 10 or 15 cents a gallon. But I do think we will see somewhat of a further fall. But whether we get to something that people might be more comfortable with, say 350, 360, I know it's high in California, but a national average, that will really depend on whether, say, the world oil price gets down to like some 70 a barrel, 60 a barrel, where it was before the pandemic.
It's interesting. I haven't seen signs that the industry is pouring money into new capital, new wells or fracking. Certainly the Biden administration has kind of been yelling at them. You already have the permits, pump more. What's happening on the capital side? Does the oil industry have cold feet about the prospect of prices staying high?
Well, I think they do, and probably with cause. So the two things that I'm sure are in their minds, and I'm not going to be terribly sympathetic to oil industry losing money, but that's, of course, what they're thinking about. If you go back to 2014, oil prices plummeted. So there was a huge fracking boom, 210 to 214 thereabout, and the price of oil fell from around 100 a barrel to bottoming out at around 40 a barrel. So a lot of these fracking wells that made sense at 100 a barrel, maybe even 90 and 80, they sure didn't make sense at 40. So a lot of them lost their shirts. Many went bankrupt. So they're very reluctant to run headlong into that. Now, the other part of the story, of course, is the Biden administration, at least outwardly, is committed to a transition to clean energy, pushing electric cars. So what's the long-term prospect for oil? Do we think that oil prices will stay at 100 a barrel? Frankly, I don't. I mean, again, my predictions on oil prices have not been worth a lot. But, you know, that's the question they're asking themselves. And I don't think it'd be foolish for them to believe that there was a strong likelihood that oil prices will fall a lot. And in that event, wells that might be really profitable at 100 a barrel may prove to be big losers, as was the case in 2014.
So I want to kind of talk about the inflation fundamentals. So the latest unemployment figures out of the federal government, 3.6% for the standard unemployment rate. Pretty close to historic lows. My understanding, like the argument that inflation is more than a transient phenomenon, it involves the idea that we're heading into a wage price spiral. There's a labor shortage. Employers start shelling out more wages to compete with each other for workers. They have to raise prices to cover the wages. Everyone starts expecting prices to go up, and it just accelerates from there. I mean, what do you think on that measure? Are there signs in the labor market that inflation might be a more enduring phenomenon?
I, of course, follow that closely, and I think most of the signs point in the opposite direction. So this is the story that Larry Summers most prominently has been saying. We're back in the 1970s where wages are going to rise because people expect inflation. They'll demand higher wages. That's going to lead to higher prices. They'll demand higher wages, and eventually we're double-digit inflation. What I see in the labor market is we're actually seeing some weakening. So opening up from the pandemic had this kind of huge reshuffling effect. We saw a massive increase in quits. People were able to leave jobs they didn't like, which to my view is a great thing. You don't see that reported much, or at least not reported on positively. But if you had a bad job, or your boss was a jerk, or his low pay was really low, whatever it was, great thing if you can quit that and work elsewhere. But we're getting through that. And what I'm looking at with the labor market is particularly the lower wage sectors, because this was where we saw the most rapid pay increases in restaurants, convenience stores, other low paying jobs. And the evidence is that their rate of wage increase is actually slowing. So I was looking at hotels and restaurants, a big sector, about 16 million workers, and very rapid pay increases over the last year, about 16% rate of wage increase from March of 2021 to March of 2022. If we compare the last 3 months with the prior 3 months, arbitrary periods, but, you know, to try and take a more recent period, the annual rate's been around 8%. So that's still high, but the point is the direction is down, not up. And you can see that for larger categories as well. So production non-supervisory workers, that's about 80% of the payroll employment. That's fallen from about 6.6% over the last year to 6.1% annual rate over the last 3 months compared to prior three. Now, that's not by any means conclusive, but the point is the evidence is that wage growth is slowing, not rising. So I don't see that there. A couple other points. We've had a big shift from wages to profits in the last year. About 2 percentage points of corporate income has flipped over from wage income to profit income. That's not consistent with wages driving inflation. And again, you saw the opposite story in the 70s. There actually was a story profits were being squeezed. So we're clearly not seeing that. Very, very different story from the 70s. The other point, the 70s, we had a big slowdown in productivity growth. So we had this long period following World War II, 47 to 73, productivity was increasing about 2.5% a year, which meant that workers could see wage growth in excess of inflation, about 2.5% a year. Suddenly that falls to about 1%. So what that meant was workers couldn't get the wage increases that they'd been expecting without spurring inflation. And that would, to my view, is an important part of the wage price spiral that we saw in the 70s. Here we actually have the opposite story. Productivity growth had actually been very slow in the teens. So it's just about 1% from 2010 to 2019. Last 3 years, it's accelerated to about 2.3%. Now, again, I don't know that will persist, but just, you know, what we have seen to date, we've seen a big uptick in productivity growth, which is very anti-inflationary. So I don't think we're seeing the 70s again. The inflation rate's higher than any of us would like to see. There's no doubt about it. But I'm still of the view that there's a lot of reasons for thinking it will slow in the not distant future.
Productivity, to refresh our audience and me too, this measures like amount of economic output, GDP, divided by hours of labor.
Exactly. And it's a really important measure because that basically says how much additional stuff is there for us to divide. And if it's rising rapidly, that means could be more wages and more profits could rise that much too. If it's not, as was the case in the 70s, then, you know, there's not much for people to divvy up.
What's the significance of capital getting an increasing share of productivity growth?
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, you have a lot of people. The administration has given some weight to this, the idea that we've had, we have increasing concentration and that companies are, in effect, using monopoly power in the crisis, in the pandemic, to jack up their prices. I think there is something to that, but to my view, it's basically a story that when you have items like oil, just take the most obvious in short supply, that it ends up, in effect, being rationed by price. How do we limit, we have so much oil, everyone wants more gas. Well, what do? You raise the price, that reduces the demand for gas, and the extra money does end up in the pocket of companies. So I think that's the basic story, that we have a lot of shortages of various items due to supply chain issues in the pandemic, and companies are the ones who are situated right now to benefit from that, and that means increasing their profits.
What would be the indications if it were principally a problem of monopoly power or monopsony power?
Well, you'd be looking for industries that are highly concentrated and seeing more evidence that profits are up there more than in other sectors. And I don't think you'd particularly find that. I mean, for one, the airline industry, I had someone telling me, oh, look, they've raised their prices. And I looked, airline prices aren't even back to where they were pre-pandemic. They might be soon, but as of March, they still weren't back to their pre-pandemic level. That's a very concentrated industry. You clearly aren't seeing that story there. The companies, several of the major companies, are just now becoming profitable again. Now, you'd have to look at that more systematically, which I've not done. I won't claim to have done. But that's what you'd look for. You'd go, okay, what are the most concentrated industries? And we have measures of that, so it's not just arbitrary. And say, are these the ones I've seen the greatest increase in profit? Someone may have done that, but not that I know of.
I'm curious, like, in the employment figures, it's a tight labor market. It's a tight labor market in the context of a million people having died from a pandemic in the past couple of years and immigration to this country, which is traditionally an enormous influx of working age people, slowing to a trickle starting during the Trump administration, but keeping up with the pandemic restrictions. Is it kind of a longer term problem for the U.S. economy?
Well, the pandemic, most of the deaths were older people, so there are people who would not have been in the labor market, not to trivialize their deaths, but, you know, in terms of its impact on the labor market, that would not be that large. Now, one wild card in this is the issue of long COVID, which we don't have good numbers on. We don't know how many people we have it, and we don't know how debilitating it is. So we don't know if it's something that, you know, in many cases it might be unpleasant, but not something that can keep you from work, whereas in other cases it clearly is debilitating. But I don't think we have very good numbers on that. The issue with immigration, yeah, I mean, we've hugely slowed the pace of immigration, and that definitely has an effect on the labor market. You know, again, it's not immediate, but it was throughout the Trump administration, even more so since the pandemic began, and that does slow people, the growth of the labor force over time, and we are seeing that. So had we not slowed immigration under Trump, surely we'd have probably another 1.5-2 million people in the labor force today. So, yeah, that's, and again, what's unfortunate is that we seem to have very little kind of thought about what immigration, the impact of immigration on the labor market, which you could argue. I mean, they're both sides in there because, you know, there are cases, I think, where immigration clearly does lower wages, but it is worth a thoughtful discussion, which we've not had.
Isn't the federal government gathering statistics on how many people are, you know, out of work because they're either reporting they're sick with COVID or caring for someone with COVID?
Yeah, so they publish that data every month, and I believe for March it was about 800,000. So that's a factor keeping people out of work, and presumably that has been falling. So just a few months ago, it was close to 2 million. So that has been falling, and presumably as we go forward, it will go down, you know, enough ever at zero, because you will still have, you know, some COVID cases, some people with long COVID, but that has come down a lot.
All right. Dean Baker, we'll leave it there. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me on.
Dean Baker is a senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research.
CEPR.net. He's a co-founding director alongside of Mark Weisbrot. Here's a quote from Baker that I used in my last September article about the WTO vaccination charade was the title of it, if you remember the context. Here's Dean Baker's quote that I used. The idea that millions of people will needlessly die because our political leaders did not want to jeopardize the profits of the pharmaceutical industry is too horrible to be aired in places like the New York Times, the Washington Post, and National Public Radio. But I've been bringing it up a lot, and so has Amy Goodman. I'm short of time. I'll only play an excerpt of Prashad, I guess, which is a shame. I guess maybe I should air all of it tomorrow as well. But we're going to stay on the economic beat with Brian Edwards Tiekert of the show Up Front. This was from the 14th, I believe. And I'll let him do the introduction here. And if I can pull this up correctly. Radio Free Labor coming up. I just sent a message asking what's on the agenda. There's so much to talk about, of course.
Since tax day is approaching, we can turn to the big picture of who actually shoulders the biggest tax burden in this society. It is certainly not the wealthiest people in America. And the investigative newsroom ProPublica has been chewing its way through a trove of documents from the IRS that they got their hands on at some point last year. Just threw up a
this is not the way I intended to broadcast this.
Highest earning but Americans pay their taxes on their income tax rate.
Well,
they're paying less than people who earn a fraction of.
Some technical difficulties here. Maybe this will
what
work.
They do when you consider it as a proportion of their total gain in wealth over the period studied, 2013 to 2018. It's a fraction of what a lot of us pay on our increase in net value. Joining us to go through the findings, Paul Keel, journalist at ProPublica, covering business and consumer finance with a focus on the IRS. Good morning.
Good morning.
Why don't you start with describing what you're working from? What are these documents from the IRS?
Sure. Well, it's a very large trove of data that includes thousands of the wealthiest Americans going back a number of years. And so we've been, as you said, going through it in a way, and you know, taxes are complicated, trying to present this in a clear way to the public to help them understand what we've come to understand, you know, working with this data over the past year or so.
So going through some of your top lines here, how do you come to the conclusion that Michael Bloomberg, who you estimate earns an average of over $2 billion a year, pays an effective federal income tax rate of just over 4%?
Yeah, his story is relatively simple compared to other people. I mean, he gives a lot of money to charity, he's big in like anti-gun stuff, and he's got his pet projects, like some other of the top earners. And then also there's a special break based on what you pay in state and local taxes that he benefited from. He was over $400 million a year, where it's wiped out from his income for federal income taxes. And you know, these sorts of things working together can lead to a really low rate for someone.
Okay, let's go to a different case then. Bill Gates, closer to $3 billion a year in average income, a tax rate, according to your calculation, that's lower than mine, 18.4%.
Right. So that we when we looked at the top 400, there was kind of two big groups that dominated at the very top of the list. And one group were like, you know, basically we called tech billionaires. So, it's Bill Gates, but it's also Jan Koum, who's started WhatsApp. And these people tend to have, to the extent they have income on their taxes, and often they're able to avoid income. But when they do have income, you know, Bill Gates sold a lot of Microsoft stock. And that is a type of income that is taxed less than if he were to have, you know, $3 billion worth of wages, it'd be taxed at a rate that's almost twice as high. So that's a big part of it. And then you add in, you know, charitable deductions, which there's a very nice thing in the tax code for people who have lots of stock, and that is you're allowed to donate your stock straight to charity, which has two benefits. One is it lowers how much income is taxed for the tax return, but also it means that that income is never taxed. You don't have to sell it and then pay tax on it and then use it as a deduction. You get to skip all that. So you get a kind of double benefit from it. And that's something that really helps these uber wealthy people pay a lower tax rate.
Four of the people on your top 10 list are people who are not household names. They're all involved with some kind of hedge fund. Ken Griffin, Citadel, Jeffrey Yass, Susquehanna International Group, and so on and so forth. The tax code kind of gives them some elaborate income tax loopholes that even the tech folks don't benefit from.
Yeah, so hedge funds really dominate the rest of the top of the list. And, you know, so Ken Griffin, I don't know if he's a household name, but he runs a massive, massive hedge fund and was, you know, earning almost $2 billion a year. You know, these are all private businesses, and the way this works is basically all of the profits accrue to these people, who, again, I don't think are known, like, you know, talked about in living rooms, but are very powerful people who are driving markets every day. And then there is private equity, which is slightly different from hedge funds. So hedge funds are people who are trading and making money on trades. Private equity, you know, are actually big in tech. You know, they invest in, you know, tech companies early on and can, you know, make a boatload of money when, you know, these companies hit it big. They are sort of famous for their ways of getting around taxes and paying lower taxes. And that sort of comes through. And what we found is that their average rate was around 21%, which for, you know, an industry that is basically trying to make money off of businesses, they end up it's quite a low tax rate, and a lot has to do with how they're able to manipulate how they account for their income. They're able to kind of count it as capital gains income, which is kind of the same thing as like selling stock, even though they're basically changing, you know, a form of fee that they're paid and transfer that into this lower tax stuff, and it really accrues to their benefit.
So capital gains, that's the difference between what you bought something for and what you sell it for. It's taxed at a maximum rate if you hold on to the thing for a while. Of 20%, a lot lower than the top income tax bracket.
Right, and that is a big part of what's happening here. Which I mean, and there's also dividends. So if you own stock and you get a dividend from stock, that is often paid taxed at this lower rate. And that is something that was actually the Bush tax cuts back in 2003. There's this big tax cut bill they passed in 2003, slashed capital gains rate. And these are forms of income that, you know, like average people don't have very much of at all. If they have any of this sort of, you know, if they own stocks or whatever, oftentimes it's in like a 401k or something like that. It's already tax advantage because of special programs that are supposed to help, you know, working people. So when you look at who has a lot of taxable, you know, dividend and capital gain income, they tend to be upper income people. But the Bush tax cuts slashed rates for those sorts of income. And then dividends was this new thing, like never in our history of the country had we treated dividends like this special form of income that should get a lower tax rate. But that's what the Bush bill did. And we looked at, you know, how much taxes were the richest people, basically the highest earners, saving from this lower rate on dividends. The biggest beneficiary was Bill Gates, who saved $125 million every single year because he has a lot of Microsoft stock. Microsoft pays dividends. And another big group was heirs of the Walmart fortune. So there, among the 400, there's 11 different heirs of the Walmart fortune because Sam Walton kind of famously saw into the future. He knew he was onto something big, and he early on kind of divvied up his empire to his kids so that he was able to pass them without dealing with estate taxes. So you have all these Walmart heirs among the top 400 are making, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars every year, and they're saving collectively, this 11, we calculated, about $370 million in taxes every single year due to this lower rate on dividends.
What's the argument from the people who defend that differential treatment? What's the argument for keeping tax rates on capital gains and dividends lower than they are on income?
I think the most basic one is this argument that, you know, they're investing in businesses and it's good for the economy. It encourages business investment, encourages the economy to grow. And so if you raised the taxes on this sort of income, it would disincentivize people to invest in businesses. Oftentimes these sorts of arguments, I think, are not super based in hard evidence, but there's a general acceptance that maybe it makes sense. It can make sense to have a lower rate. As to whether 20% is the right rate or the best rate for, like, you know, balancing, you know, getting tax revenue and helping the economy grow, I haven't really seen good evidence that it's that's true.
Your team did reach out to a bunch of the people at the top of your list to get comment on your findings about their effective taxation rate. What did you tend to hear back?
We tend to hear people stress charity. You know, last year we did a story that looked at this a little bit differently, like you referenced, like wealth growth. So, you know, you can become vastly richer and it can result in actually zero income on your tax return if you don't actually turn it into the type of income that's taxed. Like you don't sell the stock, for instance. You can just sit on your gains to get wealthier. And we pointed to Warren Buffett as a key kind of example of this. He simply just doesn't sell. And so he can grow $100 billion richer and pay, like, you know, less than 1% of that growth in taxes. And what he told us was essentially, basically, I'd rather give my money to charitable causes I want to give it to. I don't want to help, like, pay, like, you know, interest on the national debt to pay, like, the Chinese to own our treasury bills, which is, I think, a lot of that attitude that is, I think, pretty common in Silicon Valley, this idea that, you know, I could do better than the government, essentially.
Which is also a bit of a turnaround from a man who published a letter during the Obama years making the case for higher taxes on the wealthy by pointing out he pays a lower effective rate than his secretary.
Yeah, interestingly, so that's the capital gains rate that we're talking about. That's him saying, this doesn't make sense. Why am I paying a lower rate for the types of income that I have? Because I'm wealthy and I have this type of income. So he's arguing against that lower rate on that. But he I don't know, you know, it would be a bigger shift, not just to raise the tax on the type of income when you have it, but to as Biden proposed a couple weeks ago now, this idea of taxing what they call total income. In other words, if you get vastly richer, we're not going to wait to see whether you sell it or how you, you know, deal with it. We're going to tax you based on how much richer you're getting, what they call total income. So if you get $100 billion richer, you're going to pay taxes on $100 billion. That idea that they call
the
billionaire.
So the idea is taxing your stock portfolio the way real estate gets taxed. You pay property taxes every year. It's just a percentage of the value of the property.
Yeah.
And that's a point that our guest doesn't take on. The host is Brian Edwards Tiekert, and that was a guy from ProPublica. Can find that on Upfront. Actually, you can't find it. That's why I've had trouble bringing it to you. It was edited out of the online archive for some reason. But yeah, Warren Buffett's, somebody's got to ask him, why did you change your mind about paying less percentage of your income than your cleaning lady? I promised Vijay Prashad, and we'll get a bulk of it on, maybe a couple of minutes on the outside. He's quite cogent, it seems to me. He was here 2017 because he was invited to speak at the campus-wide commemoration, I guess it wasn't a celebration for everyone, of the Russian Revolution. And he's a acute observer from around the world. Here's Amy introducing him, I believe. Juan is on board as well. This is from yesterday's show, but can't get enough of Vijay Prashad. Opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. In part, Radio Free Labor coming up.
Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The head of the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, warned Thursday that Russia's invasion of Ukraine will lead to more hunger and social unrest across the globe. The IMF managing director, Kristalina Georgieva, spoke in Washington.
In the past 7 weeks, the world has experienced a second major crisis, a war on top of a pandemic. This risks eroding much of the progress we have made over the past 2 years, climbing back from COVID. Add to this the growing threat of fragmentation into geopolitical and economic blocs. In a world where war in Europe creates hunger in Africa, where a pandemic can circle the globe in days and reverberate for years, where emissions anywhere means rising sea levels everywhere. The threat to our collective prosperity from a breakdown in global cooperation cannot be overstated. The root cause of what we face today is the war. And it is the war that must end.
IMF Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva speaking Thursday. To talk more about how the war in Ukraine is reverberating around the world, we're joined by Vijay Prashad, director of the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research and chief correspondent of Globetrotters. He's the author of many books, including The Poorer Nations, A Possible History of the Global South, and Washington Bullets, A History of the CIA, Coups and Assassinations. Vijay Prashad is joining us from Santiago, Chile. Welcome to Democracy Now! Vijay, if you can talk about how Russia's war on Ukraine is reverberating across the globe.
First, Amy, Happy New Year. It's Happy New Year in my birth area of Bengal today. It's an interesting period to commemorate the end of a year, which one thought would bring us, as the head of the IMF said, out of the pandemic. And instead, of course, it's brought us into war and sanctions. I want to remind people that a decade ago, when there was a drought in Ukraine and in Russia, where about 25% of the world's wheat is exported into. When there was that drought in 2010, there was a major uprising, not only in the Arab world, which we call the Arab Spring, but across the African continent, now long forgotten, I think. It's important to remember that when there's a crisis in food and when food prices go up, the political crisis is almost immediate. There's already been an economic crisis in Sri Lanka that's metastasized into a political crisis. We've seen the government fall in Pakistan. Around the world, we see food price inflation creates serious problems for governments. Before this war and the sanctions against Russia, 2.7 billion people struggled with hunger. It's likely that we'll go above 3 billion before the month is over. We're also going to see, I think, catastrophic problems with disruptions in fuel distribution. But I want to say one thing about this, Amy, that, you know, it's not a... It looks, when you watch the news, perhaps in the West, it looks like a world of certainty. Everybody seems clear about what's happening. In the rest of the world, I think people are really trying to breathe in the contradictions. They understand that this is a ghastly war, but there have been ghastly wars before this. I think there's some perplexity about why this war is treated as so different than other wars. I think in the contradictions, countries are not willing to break ties with Russia or to cut the import of grain and fuel from places like Russia. They have their own populations to take care of, and they have to consider their needs and their desires.
And Vijay, I wanted to ask you, it's not only the governments of many of these countries that are not buying into the call for sanctions on Russia, but some of the public opinion polling has shown that in many countries, in Indonesia, in Brazil, in South Africa, in many countries in the global south, the public has a different opinion about this this war as well.
Well, there's no question that this is a terrible war. I mean, like all wars, this is brutal, this is nasty, and so on. But let's take an example. There was an appalling bombing of the maternity hospital in Mariupol. You know, immediately thereafter, the U.S. government talked about war crimes. The International Criminal Court was suborned to say that this is going to have a file open, you know, for war crimes personally against Mr. Putin and so on. But have we forgotten the Amaria shelter, 1,500 civilians killed in 1991 when the United States bombed a shelter, knowing full well there were civilians there? No question of any interrogation of war crimes. The language of war crimes was not used. In Libya, after NATO quite ruthlessly bombed that country, Peter Olson of NATO, the lead attorney, said openly, look, NATO can't commit war crimes. War crimes are committed by other people, not by NATO. I mean, just this recent month, there were Israeli airstrikes which struck the Rimal Medical Center. Two doctors killed. Do we know their names? Ayman Abu Al-Auf and Moen Alolu. I mean, they were killed in the middle of all this, but there was no question of calling the Israeli strikes war crimes. So this kind of open, rank hypocrisy, I think, is what is striking lots of people around the world. I have to say, Juan, that, you know, I made a speech in Glasgow where I questioned the colonial mentality of the West regarding climate policy. That speech has been viewed by hundreds of millions of people on WhatsApp groups all around the world, including by right-wing WhatsApp groups in India. People are frustrated with the kind of colonial way in which the Western powers and the Western media reports things. The very fact that you know the flag coloring of Ukraine, but have no idea what the flag of Yemen looks like, what the flag of Palestine looks like, what the flag of the Congo looks like, and needless to say, what the flag of Iraq looks like. I mean, that has frustrated a lot of people and is driving public opinion.
And what's your reaction to the President Biden's recent meeting with President Modi on Monday?
It's very interesting. You know, it's not just Biden. The U.S. State Department sent a high official. The British foreign ministry sent their leading cabinet minister, the foreign secretary, Liz Truss. They all went to India to say, look, how is it possible that India, governed by a right-wing country led by Narendra Modi, a subordinate ally of the United States, a member of the Quad, how is it that India is not willing to come out there and attack the Russian war in Ukraine? How is it that India is not willing to condemn Vladimir Putin and so on? This is a full court press. And inside India, there's been a great deal of frustration. There's questions raised about the so-called finger wagging at India for India's policy. I think that what people need to understand, this is not just India. I mean, India has been, I suppose, the most forthright in refusing to come out there and condemn this war. It's not just India. Look at Germany. Germany continues to buy energy from Russia. The German chancellor directly told Mr. Biden that, look, if Germany breaks ties with Russia, bans natural gas imports, Germany will plunge into a terrible recession. The Japanese prime minister has also told the United States and told the Russians directly, look, we're quite happy to sign on to the G7 statement condemning Russia and its war, but we're not going to cut ties. We're not going to stop importing liquefied natural gas from Sakhalin 2. We're not going to stop importing crude oil. And furthermore, Japan is one of the major investors in Sakhalin 2 and Sakhalin 1. These are very large and important energy projects of the Russian people, Russian government, but also private sector. And it's the Japanese state that has invested in them. It's not willing to cut all that. So the United States, I think, is coming to realize, or I hope it comes to realize, that many countries, not only so-called adversarial countries, but also countries that are closely allied, like Germany, Japan, India and so on, are just not willing to break ties. And just let me say one thing about that. You know, for 30 plus years, the U.S. government pushed a globalization agenda, which integrated countries with each other. Russia was at the core of that integration, not only for the export of fuel, but also for the export of the wealth stolen from the state of the USSR after it collapsed. All that money taken by billionaires was invested in international financial markets, and having integrated the world. Now, suddenly, as the head of the IMF pointed out, suddenly two major shocks take place, the pandemic and then the war and the sanctions. And these two shocks have not been shocks merely to people's household budgets and so on, but they've been shocks to the level of integration of the world economy. And it's very hard for countries to disentangle on a dime. Just because the U.S. White House says break ties, it's not easy to break ties. It's not a question of political connections. This is a question of deep structural economic relations which cannot be broken. If they break, it will plunge these countries into even greater catastrophe.
During a news conference Monday, India's External Affairs Minister, S. Jaishankar, pointed out Europe buys far more Russian oil and gas than India. This is what he said.
If you are looking at energy purchases from Russia, I would suggest that your attention should be focused on Europe, which probably we do buy some energy, which is necessary for our energy security. But I suspect, looking at the figures, probably our total purchases for the month would be less than what Europe does in an afternoon. So you might want to think about it.
So, Vijay Prashad, you can comment on that, but also, as you talk about the rank hypocrisy, I mean, you have not only the United States, but Europe talking about Putin's war crimes. Where would he be tried? A logical forum would be the International Criminal Court. Neither the United States nor Russia, nor Ukraine, for that matter, has fully signed on to the International Court. It is pointed out over and over again, anti-personnel landmines, just brutal, focused on killing people that Russia is using in Ukraine. The U.S. hasn't signed on to the anti-landmine treaty that, for example, Princess Di had so campaigned for. So you have all these international treaties that the United States has not respected, and yet at this point is really invoking the foundation of them to hold Putin accountable. So talking about, as you talk about the rank hypocrisy, do you also criticize, though, Putin for invading Ukraine?
Of course, I criticize Putin for invading Ukraine, Amy. That goes without saying, because he has violated the UN Charter. It is a brutal war, as I said when I first started speaking. But I think that's hardly the question whether I condemn Mr. Putin or not. The issue is that we're living in a world where, for a lot of people, it looks like it's an upside-down world. It's not just the question of the treaties you mentioned. The United States government has not signed the international laws of the seas, and yet it prosecutes so-called freedom of navigation missions against not only China in the South China Sea, using this UN Charter, which it's not a signatory of, but it has been provoking clashes with Russia in the Black Sea, in the Baltic Sea, and in the Arctic Sea, again, using these so-called freedom of navigation missions. Let's take the question of the International Criminal Court. When Special Prosecutor Fatih Bensouda opened a file to investigate war crimes in Afghanistan, and by the way, she was really clear. She said war crimes conducted by everybody, by the Taliban, by the Afghan National Army, by the United States, by other NATO countries, and so on. When she did that, the United States government threatened her, told her that neither she nor her family would ever get a visa to come to the United States, and so on. The U.S. put enormous pressure on the International Criminal Court to shut down that investigation. That's incredible. This is an investigation of war crimes which are detailed in the U.S. government's own documents, which had been released by the WikiLeaks Foundation, whose founder, Julian Assange, is sitting in Belmarsh prison, is being treated as a criminal, whereas the war criminals in Afghanistan are going free and threatening with mafia-like tactics the special prosecutor at the ICC. Meanwhile, again, in an afternoon, to quote the Indian high official, in an afternoon, the United States is able to get these bodies established by international law, which the United States is not a signatory to. The U.S. in an afternoon is able to get them to open a file and start talking about war crimes. Over 1 million people killed in Iraq and no investigation of war crimes. None. Over 1 million people. 500,000 children killed in Iraq during the 1919 sanctions regime. Not even the word genocide. The West is walking all over the word genocide, is reducing the power of an important category, of an important convention, the 1951 Convention Against Genocide. This extraordinary casual and weaponization of human rights and the word genocide by the West is going to be something that we are going to face in the times ahead, when other countries are going to say, well, we can do anything if we are backed by Washington, D.C. This is extraordinarily perilous, and I hope people open their eyes to the very cynical way in which Washington, D.C. is approaching this terrible war taking place in Ukraine, a war that has to end with a ceasefire and negotiations. And you're not going to easily get a ceasefire and negotiations if you're going to loosely, as Mr. Biden did in Poland at Warsaw Castle, loosely call for regime change in Russia. That is not going to help you bring people to the table, whether it's in Belarus or it's in Antalya, Turkey. It's not going to bring Ukraine and Russia to the table. It's not going to stop Russia's war. If the Russians think that the United States has a total agenda to annihilate the Russian government, I'm afraid then you're not going to get a ceasefire. You're going to just get more atrocities in Ukraine. And that's something that the people of the world should not stand for.
And Vijay, I wanted to ask you, while this is continuing to play out, this war in Europe, the role of China, and of course, as you mentioned earlier, the United States has identified China as its long-term strategic foe. Could you talk about what this means about the relationship of these empires and China's role in the world?
Well, we'll have to leave that question hanging in the air. That's Juan Gonzalez from yesterday's Democracy Now! With Vijay Prashad, the Tricontinental Institute. It's Tricontinental, thetricontinental.org. You have to put the in front of it. Somebody else's Tricontinental. Harkens back to a bit of history, which isn't a surprise for Vijay Prashad, formerly at Trinity College in Connecticut, not Ireland. Thanks for listening. Opinions are those of the speakers. You can hear the rest of that at the Democracy Now! Website. It's time now for Radio Free Labor. But more immediately, it's time for a little underwriting announcement from Gina. Gina's here at hand, in a way, to bring that to you. Support Community Media. Thanks for your efforts.
Programming at WEFT is brought to you in part by Common Ground Food Co-op. Food that nourishes you and gives back to your community may be found at Common Ground Food Co-op, located in Lincoln Square Mall. Your dollar stays local when you shop Co-op. They've been cultivating community and local food since 1974.
Sigh, groan, moan. We're reading like mad here.